Welcome back to a new episode of Cinema D'Amore. I'm Justin Morgan. I'm here with
Chuck Phillips.
So what do you say? Join me?
Okay.
And we are discussing Big Fish today in my connecting theme, which is essentially characters having some revelation, like big connection that takes the course of the film to get to. In this case, it is father and son, and I don't think we have any other father and sons, because you boldly made sure you didn't have any in your picks.
Nope. No parents, no. None of that type of stuff going on. I don't know, I guess we have a family, more of a family relationship in your second movie, but it's not the same. It's not a father-son relationship.
Right. Like, you unmuted for a second, and I just hear birds chirping. Chuck is out in nature today, which is where our movie takes place, in the big-ass river.
I was waiting for you. You looked like you were about to say something, so I was waiting for you.
I was just going to say that ever since I watched Big Fish, which is probably my last really, really favorite Tim Burton movie, I've always loved it. And it's also one of those movies, like, I contemplated on if I had a theme about movies that always make you cry, because I always ugly cry when I watch this movie. And it's weird because I'm sure as you start watching this movie, you'd be like, where the fuck's he going to cry at? This is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. But yeah, it's just, it has one of the most moving endings, I think. Or at least it's moving, it moves me every time, it never gets old. But yeah, I really love this cast. Ewan McGregor coming off of that Star Wars money. Well, I guess he still had one more Star Wars, right?
Yeah, because this would have been the year after Attack of the Clones. So he still would have had Revenge of the Sith next.
Yeah, he had to start growing that beard.
Yeah. This is the last one he got all clean shaven, probably. Yeah, I agree. I think everyone in the movie is good.
My biggest upset is, I think his name is like Matt McGorry, the giant, the guy that plays Carl the Giant. He was in Rob Zombie's movies. He played Tiny Firefly or whatever, that really massive thing. And obviously he died from his gigantism or whatever, like a heart condition or something like that. But I always thought that he kind of has really good charisma in this movie, and you don't really see it in his other things when he's playing basically a Rob Zombie monster.
Every time I hear any of those stories about the guys that are giants, like Andre the Giant, someone like him, the guy that's the tallest man in the world ever, Robert Wadlow, like, their lives all sound so tragic because they're literally just too large for anything to work for them. Like, it's completely out of their control. Once they hit a certain point, it's just like, yeah, you don't fit in cars, you don't fit in doorways, you can't fit into anything, and
your heart's trying to stop.
Yeah, your body literally wants to kill you because it doesn't want to do its job anymore. And that's what most of those guys always said, was that everyone, they always hated going out into crowds because everyone just wanted to stare at them. And they said they couldn't, once you're that tall, you can't go anywhere that people won't just see you from a distance. You stick out in a crowd so badly that you can't go anywhere that you're not going to be immediately recognized as, oh, look at the 8-foot tall guy standing there, like, and then people gawk at him. So it's good to see him in this, and he's not treated as a joke. They don't like mess around with his height or his size as being like anything funny. And like, if anything, he gets respect, like the way Danny DeVito sees him and, you know, is in awe of him. He doesn't, even though he kind of sounds like he wants to trick him into working for him. But
that is a great moment too, where they have the strong man and then it's just like, wait, like, hold up. I got something for you. We got Carl the Giant.
Yeah.
He's twice the size of your strong
man. He's twice the size of your Colossus.
Yeah, I think that Ewan McGregor is an interesting choice because he has like the above average, like pretty guy look to him, as opposed to Tim Burton always usually choosing somebody that looks odd. Like, he loves odd looking people. I'm sure if you showed up as an extra and you just were misshapen, they would say, bingo, and you have a speaking part.
Yeah, he does usually like to feature, yeah, like the outcasts or outsiders. This almost feels like a story where I guess it's not the point that even the weird people can be out of place. It's that everyone's somewhat out of place, even given his Ewan McGregor, his portrayal as a big fish in a small pond. Like, even someone that seems like he has everything going for him is still feels like an outsider. He feels like he doesn't belong in his small town and that he needs to break out and go somewhere else so that he can continue his dreams because his ambitions are too big. So I think he plays with that idea very well in using it a different way. Other than everyone physically being odd looking, it's everyone just their personality wise, they feel like they need to go somewhere bigger and better.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, he seems to be, he's not average for, he is kind of like a weird, quirky character from the beginning of the movie. And he's over happy. I don't know how to describe it. He's always happy. He's always looking at the bright side of everything.
Yeah, he's just optimistic immediately.
He may be overly optimistic about every situation. I do like how this movie essentially, I have never read the book, but it pulls from a lot of like classic fairy tales, or if not fairy tales, like little sayings and stuff, like, you know, about the road less taken, and they literally take the road. He literally takes the road less taken in this. I guess this fits too with an unreliable narrator. But I think that it feels great. Like, I really love the idea of Billy Crudup. I don't know how old he's supposed to be. He was like the same age in the beginning when he was supposed to be in high school at prom or whatever he was.
Well, they do the same thing with Ewan McGregor. They show him on like the high school football team when it's clearly like 40-year-old Ewan McGregor. Or when he gets a specter and that little girl goes, "How old are you?" And he's like, "Well, I'm 18. Makes me like a Dewey Cox. If it isn't my 12-year-old Dewey Cox.
Yeah, that's kind of exactly what it is. Yeah, I love all the storybook aspect. They're just so much fun with it. I like every little scene, like when he goes to see the witch and they bring up how you can see the way that you die and just the way that they're like, "I think you should do it. I think I will do it. Are you going to do it? I'm absolutely going to do it." And instead of it being like really scary, like a scary scene, they kind of just like immediately make the witch like a prop. I love when he's like, they're like, "Did you bring the eye?" And she's just like standing behind him like, "Oh yeah, I brought the eye." He's a sweet talker, yeah. Except for the one guy in high school who he basically ruins his life by being better than
Roy.
And then proceeds to call him a jerk. He's like, "He's just a jerk." I'm like, he took everything away from Roy.
It really is. It almost is exactly like Roy from The Office. Like he's just going about his life, and then Ewan McGregor sees Alison Lohman and is like, "I'm going to marry that girl. She's engaged to someone else." And he's like, "I don't care." And then Roy's just like, "I can't believe you're trying to steal my girlfriend." And he's just like, "I have to do it, man. I'm going to steal your girlfriend." And then in the end, he's just played off as a joke that he died. He died on the toilet.
He got all worked up from beating up Ewan McGregor. It kind of was like a happy version of the Dead Zone where he's, you know, where he touches, where he tries to assassinate Martin Sheen's character, and Martin Sheen picks up that baby. So he knows that like he, even though he dies, he knows that he was successful in stopping World War III by having him grab that baby. And this is the same scenario where he's getting this shit punched out of him. And it's just like, he's like, it was just like, "I know I won because he died after this." He got his heart, he got all worked up and he died on the toilet. I don't know. If I was that guy, I would never want to take a shit inside a bathroom ever.
Yeah. Well, maybe.
I'd be shitting outside. They'd be like, "Why are you always outside?" I'd be like, "I saw how I was going to die."
Maybe he just didn't believe it.
Yeah.
He didn't have that conviction that was how he was going to die.
I did like that. I was old and I fell. I wasn't old at all. It's great. A lot of great cast of characters in this too. Steve Buscemi's wonderful in this.
That whole section's really fun when he takes that road less traveled and ends up in Spectre, which is like a weird like afterlife type thing. Like they're like, we weren't expecting you yet. You're early. That's the part of the movie that feels the most like a Twilight Zone episode. Like, there are a bunch of Twilight Zone episodes where the character stumbles onto some town from out of the past or something like that, and is very confused. And they're like, no, you can't leave. Like in a more horror setting, it would literally be that he was trapped there forever.
They kind of do try where they take his shoes from him. And he's like, I'm going to leave. How are you going to leave? He's like, well, I'm assuming it's going to hurt, but I'm still going to go. Yeah, it is. Because they thought that what's the name of the poet that Steve Buscemi plays? They think that he is...
Norther Winslow.
Yeah, they think that he just like left or some... It sounds like he died the way they were. The way they word it makes it sound like he just died, like he got lost in the woods and died. But yeah, he's great. I love him. When you're first introduced to him and they're just like that weird, like smiling as they're eating the pie and rocking back and forth, it almost feels kind of Lynchian.
He's got his great poetry. Roses are red, violets are blue. I like Spectre. And he just leaves it like that. Oh, working on this for 15 years.
I do like when he rips it out of his Ewan McGregor's hands and he's like, that's why you never show a work in progress. Yeah, that is funny. And I do like when they're dancing and he's dancing with, like, I don't know, the mayor. And then Steve Buscemi starts like dancing behind him. Like it looks like he's like a little kid trying to get in his line of sight.
Yeah, but he just couldn't stay there. He had to keep on moving on.
Yeah, it's like you don't really realize how bad that place had gotten, I think, until you see, it looks like it's the 70s or something, when he meets him at the bank, and he's now a bank robber, which is like, I love that moment, too, where they open up the vault, and there's literally nothing in the vault.
Yeah, and when he counts all the money later and says, what do we get in the vault? I'm like, I know it wasn't a lot, and he's like... This deposit slip has your name on it. He's like, well, I didn't want you to feel like you were getting nothing for your trouble. Like he's just that good of a guy that he was even going to give him his own money to help him feel better about it.
Yeah. Then he finds out that the town's basically died off. And, Helen Bonham Carter, who plays the witch, also plays the little girl when she's grown up. And it mixes with the ages again, too, because she doesn't look like she would be in her 20s when she's supposed to be.
Yeah, she's still supposed to be 10 years younger than Ewan McGregor's character.
I do like the tilted house and everything. So he has a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's like his one. That is almost like the one, like, very, very standard. Like, the set looks like something out of, like... The cabinet of Dr. Caligari with all the lines going crooked and stuff like that. It gets the giant to straighten it out for him.
I love the door that won't open after he closes it, when he tries to make his exit. Yeah, he's trying to clean up the town and everything. It is like several small stories, maybe like 12 smaller stories that kind of make up all the stories. But the overall story... deals with the son, like, it was fun when he was a kid, but then he's hurt him so many times that he's just kind of numb to them and doesn't feel that he knows anything about his father at all. So, yeah, I feel like we probably feel that way about our parents, too. Maybe not necessarily like they're telling fish stories, but there's a huge chunk of their lives that you don't know anything about.
Yeah, I know that's like a... And I don't know if that ever came from, I'm the same as you. I never read the book or anything. Cause I know that's like something that a lot of people bring up when their parents were in, World War II and things like that, which that's his characters in World War II that they said like, oh yeah, like their father doesn't talk about the war at all because it was so like such a crazy experience that they're just like, there's just like a whole chunk of their life that they just never talk about because they don't want to ever bring it up again. So yeah, Billy Crudup kind of feels like, yeah, his father hides behind all the stories because like he feels his life maybe was more boring than it was, or that he's trying to hide things. He thinks that Helena Bonham Carter's like a secret wife that he had or something like that, and that he's always been out, you know, living a life with a better family because he didn't like his own family.
Yeah, and everybody likes him. Like, well, or they're dead.
Those, yeah, the only like, guy that ever, that's his power. The only man that ever hated him died.
Yeah, I mean, I just really like how, you know, his father's older and he's starting to have some problems. So Billy Crudup comes back. And there's that moment where he's like talking to the doctor and the doctor's like, oh, I remember your birth. And he explains it in the most boring way. And he's like, I don't know, it's really not that interesting that way. Is that, you know, is that the story that you want to tell people, or do you want to tell them the more exciting story?
Yeah. The my favorite part of that is when he tells him the story about the day that actually happened. And then he kind of gives him the reason for why he would want to make a better story out of it anyway, because he brings up the fact that, well, in those days, the men wouldn't be in the room with the wife anyway. So, he says, I really don't see how it could be any different if he were here in the building. He still wouldn't have been in the room with you. He wouldn't have been doing anything. So, yeah, why wouldn't you want to have a better story for that day that people actually like to hear about other than... Yeah, what was his original story would have been? Oh, yeah, I was sitting in the waiting room for 6 hours, and then my kid was here.
And I wasn't allowed to touch them or see them.
Yeah.
Great story.
Yeah. Yeah, there's... I do really like Albert Finney's performance, too. Like, he is really fun in this film of... Like, he doesn't seem senile or anything like that. He's definitely still completely in control, but... He just kind of has that natural, like, he loves to tell stories. He loves to entertain people and wants everyone to be happy all the time. That's almost his, I guess, his flaw that his son sees in him, that, you know, he can't ever turn the charm off. He can't ever just be the serious guy. Like, even in a super serious situation, he's still going to want to tell the story of the fish or a flying car or a giant. He's just always going to want to tell those stories because that's just how he is and he just can't turn it off.
Yeah, that's like with Billy Crudup's wife, who's played by Marion Cotillard. She was there's like a moment where she goes in and she's like talking to him and they start like laughing and giggling and stuff, and Billy Crudup can like hear it in the hallway, and it's just like, yeah, that's his dad's like magic touch, is that he can kind of like woo people over fairly quickly with his stories and his like jokes and stuff that he has. Cause some of his stories are just jokes, but yeah, Albert Finney is great in this. Jessica Lange's great in it. The whole cast is really good in this, even if it's people that don't end up doing a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Even the smallest characters like Danny DeVito probably has the least amount of screen time out of kind of like any of the main cast type characters as the ringleader. And he has Deep Roy as Mr. Soggy Bottom, his personal attorney, which even that one small moment with them is like a really good moment for almost nothing, of just finding out that Danny DeVito's a werewolf. And when he attacks and he pulls out the gun with the one silver bullet that he always, you know, must carry with him just to make sure. And he just cries like a solitary tear. And you're just like, I'm like, I don't know why this is like such a sad moment that Mr. Soggy Bottom is going to shoot Danny DeVito as a werewolf. But they like Tim Burton somehow makes that moment feel like so emotional.
Yeah, it's a great moment because you start seeing these like, every situation is fantastical. Everything is, it couldn't be believed. It sounds like a story that you would tell a little kid. And I can get Billy Crudup being like over it. So I feel like that's kind of where the magic really falls into the towards the end of this movie for me, is when things come together and you like you start seeing these characters, like when they start showing up. I guess it's more in like the resolution, but when they start showing up at the funeral and they're all real people, or at least they're like real versions of themselves. Like the Carl the Giant shows up, Danny DeVito shows up, and
yeah, they're all just slight exaggerations. Like Carl isn't, you know, he's not actually 15 feet tall, but he is very tall. Like he is actually a giant, and there are Asian twins. They're not Siamese twins. Conjoined twins. That was just a fantastical thing that he added. And it's one of those none of the stories were lies. That's what he accuses his father is. Oh, you've only ever told me lies. And it's that everything he told him was true, but it was just always, he always had to add a little thing. He couldn't just, you know, nothing could just be a normal thing. It always had to have like that one little extra thing added to it to make it even more fantastical or make it more interesting. But, you know, he never would lie. He would never just flat out make things up. Everything always had a kernel of truth in it.
Right, like when he was with his mother and he found that letter about him possibly being dead or missing during the war, and he's like, I thought Dad made this up. And she says almost exactly what you say, like, no, it happened. I mean, he definitely exaggerates some things, but yeah, it's stuff like that. I love things like that, or like the little touches. Like I love when he's out by the pole and the fish is in it for like no reason at all besides like maybe the start to stir his imagination or something.
It's like his imagination's like picking up or something just because he's like been around his dad and he's starting like he's slowly started to think that maybe some of this stuff isn't as made up as he once thought it was, so that he starts seeing things even happening.
I mean, it has kind of some similar touches to another movie that I enjoy, which is The Fountain, where it's like this guy has got to finish his wife's story, who's an author, but he's just like not basically narrow-minded, but he's not very imaginative.
He's a man of science, Hugh Jackman's character in The Fountain. Yeah, he thinks more, everything about him's logic, not fantasy. That's what he accuses his wife of, is diving into these fantastical scenarios. Like she can't focus on what's really happening, the fact that she's dying, which his father kind of does the same thing. Like when he goes in, the first thing he says is, oh, don't worry, this isn't how it happens. Like I saw it from the witch. I know this isn't how I die. You don't have to worry about me.
There's also a good moment too, where, Billy Crudup's wife goes to get something, and you could tell that Albert Finney's like in a lot of pain. It's just like momentary. And when she comes back in, he like kind of goes back into like acting and pretending that he's fine, which is like a nice moment of like, he does kind of like fit that mindset of the character that he's built up as, that like he doesn't have problems of his own. He's solving everybody else's problems, usually unintentionally, but he just always makes every scenario better just by him being there. Every scenario, just like he's basically fixes lives intentionally or not. Like sometimes it's a happy accident. Other times he's like, yeah, I'm going to buy the town. I'm going to fix this up. You know, I'm going to help you out.
Yeah, it's just in his nature to help everyone, get everything together. Yeah, he brings the Asian twins back to America with him. He comes up with some kind of crazy plot to get them all smuggled back to America and gets them into show business. I do love I know the biggest guy in show business, Bob Hope, even better.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's, I don't know. I do really enjoy this movie. I think it plays pretty well. It just happened that we did The Fisher King followed by Big Fish, which are, you know, they both kind of deal with characters that live in a fantasy world or kind of have their own imaginations that run wild, and their interactions with those around them that, you know, want to keep trying to bring them back to reality. Obviously for different reasons, Robin Williams is a little bit lost because of some trauma, whereas, you know, Albert Finney, Ewan McGregor is the main character, just likes it, just likes to kind of live in that fantasy world. If it's worth talking about, it's worth exaggerating about.
Even though I have a sad, ugly cry at the end of this movie every time I watch it, it is, I would say, the happiest movie probably out of all four of them that we're covering for this theme. Like, they're all get a little bit depressed. I mean, I guess Fisher King does have a happy ending, but it is depressing as hell, like, up until it gets to that point.
Yeah.
This doesn't have anything, like, it's not depressing. It's, like, it's bittersweet. Like, it's I think that's the emotion I get. It's just, like, I get caught up in it.
Yeah. I feel the same way. I get, yeah, it's not sad. It definitely isn't a sad ending because everyone kind of finally, you know, understands each other, I guess is the way to put it. When you're talking about your theme being people connecting at the end of a movie, it's finally, you know, took them, you know, I guess Billy Crudup's probably supposed to be like 40s or something, or late 30s or something.
22.
Did you find? Sure. Sure, we'll say he's 22. You have Billy Crudup, that 22-year-old. But yeah, they finally, you know, they finally understand each other. And yeah, I guess that's the bittersweet part of it that you're talking about, that it took up to the end of his life for them to finally understand each other and finally communicate. Since he hasn't talked to his father in 3 years before he's dying.
Yeah, it's, yeah, you just get this, you can tell that he loves his dad. He's just kind of tired of who his dad is. And he doesn't really understand why anybody would want to be like that. And early on in the film, you see how his dad's telling a story to all the Boy Scouts, and they're all super excited with the story, but he's tired of it because he's heard it for the 100th time. So it is kind of nice where he basically says that he's going to watch his dad that night, who's not doing really well in the hospital, as like the single guest that can spend the night. And his dad's not doing well, and they basically expect him to pass that night. And he has that like same thing that he stuck to the whole entire time, where he's like, well, this is the way I die. Like, I've watched the way that I've died. And I'm always interested too, because Billy Crudup then delves into fantasy. Like, he caters to his dad in that moment. So I wonder if it's like Albert Finney's character, like, did he foresee the story that his son told him, or was it that his son was like telling that story?
That's the way I took it was not that his son would like tell this grand story, but that was perhaps what he saw. If we're believing that he saw something in the witch's eye, if that was a real thing, since we have to say that, even Helena Bonham Carter brings up earlier when he visits her inspector and, you know, tries to find out who she is, and she's the little girl. She even says, you know, the story ends where it begins and I become the witch. And, you know, Ewan McGregor says, or Billy Crudup says, well, you can't be the witch. She was old and dead. And she even says, like, it doesn't really matter. It's always just, what she says, that there's only two women in your father's world, his wife and everybody else. So it's even that story, like, who knows how much that story has truth, that he saw anything in the witch's eye. But I think if we're believing that he saw something, I always just saw it as he saw himself like dying with his son next to him, like taking care of him. Not that he saw him like telling this grand story, but just that he had his son with him at the end there.
Yeah, their big escape is great too.
Yeah,
where he has that fantasy where they basically escape the hospital, and I just love when he gets in, when he's like, I need water, and he just like pours it on his head instead of like drinking it.
Yeah. Yeah, those are a lot of good moments there. Yeah, when they're running out and both of their wives are there, and they just go, quick, you got to stop them. They just knock the orderlies over.
Like violently, yeah. Violently take out those orderlies. Throw
that card into them, yeah. Yeah, that whole final scene, yeah, pretty much from the, I guess I would say that's where, and I'm assuming it's probably the same for you, that's where the tears start is when he's describing the escape. And then it just doesn't stop till the end of the movie. It's just that entire last 20 minutes.
I think it's also too because Billy Crudup starts getting like really emotional in that moment. Like he's like teared up, and it's kind of like partially because he's giving into his father and doing something nice for his father, but then also like realizing what's happening. So then so then the waterworks start. And it gets weirder and weirder and weird. Like, it's just all these weird people showing up that you've seen the whole movie. Which feels like, I don't know what it is. It feels like it matches that kind of, like, storybook tale that you'd be told. But it also kind of matches that when you die, it's like everybody that you've seen your whole life. So it's kind of generic, but it also kind of, it fits so well into what's happening in this movie.
Yeah, I always like that. Yeah, when he goes to the, he takes him to the river, and everyone, like the mayor of the town, the people from Spectre, everyone he's ever seen. And I guess that's also just a part of, kind of like you were saying, that idea that everyone you've ever seen meets you at the end, and like that they affected him and he affected them as well. So it's that kind of relationship where he wouldn't be that type of person if he didn't meet all these people. They all changed his life. But again, it seems like that's everyone at the funeral at the end. Like, we don't hear those conversations, but we see like everyone's reactions. They're all telling the stories of like, oh yeah, I remember when Edward did this, and when Norther Winslow's probably, you imagine he's describing them on like some sort of bank heist or something like that, and telling that type of story. And Danny DeVito, talking about them being at the circus, and goddamn it.
Yeah, exactly. All those things. We don't have to hear it. I mean, the little bit that you heard from his mother telling him, that it's always based in some sort of truth. So we recognize all these people, like, oh, that's old Steve Buscemi and old Danny DeVito. We know who they are from the story. But yeah, I'm sure these, all these moments that wouldn't really work on the film, they work better how they're told as like a resolution after the big climax of the movie. But I also think that it's a super nice touch that it essentially ends with the real world version of these people, and more so how he's affected them, because they all show up to his funeral. So they're all like they're all important to him, and he was important to them. So I think that's kind of nice. And I do like too how the movie has that it begins in the river with Ewan McGregor's character. And it ends with Billy Crudup in the same river after his dad turns into a big fish, literally. It's a good moment, too. It's a good special effect, too. I think it looks really good, where he just dunks him in the water and he just swims away.
Yeah, I think all the effects in this movie look really good. Like, nothing looks fake. I think he did a really good job of blending actual effects, like I guess just using like an actual trained wolf or dog to play the werewolf character instead of doing like a CGI sort of thing. Like he does most of the things fairly practical, I would say. I assume he just says some like forced perspective and some CG shots for the giant to make him look larger than he actually is. But all in all, I think everything looks really great. I do love the effect of time freezing when he says, you know, when you see the love of your life, time freezes. And when he's walking through and the cat is like flying over his head from the one guy's trick. And then he knocks all the popcorn down as he walks through. And then everything speeds back up because it has to catch back up on itself. Funny. And she just disappears from his view and he doesn't know where she went. So
it's good commentary too on that, like how time stops when you see the love of your life. Cause that is like, you know, your heart sinks type of situation. And so a lot of movies, they've done the melodramatic, like the first time they meet. So the speeding up when it's like, yeah, but what they don't tell you is how reality catches up and like the whole circus is over and she's gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it would be, if they'd have played it like most other movies would, where time would have stopped and then, he would have got over to her. And then at that moment, just been like, you're the person I'm going to marry and I love you. So yeah, that's a great moment. And I love that whole following montage of the deal he makes with Danny DeVito, that every month he'll tell him one fact about her. And we see him in all those different scenarios. Like he gets hit by that ride that throws him through the air into a field. And he's in the ring of death with all the motorcycle guys like going, mm-hmm. She likes music, like something so basic like that. Cause he's just giving him these random facts.
It almost sounds like he doesn't know who this girl is. He's just using him.
Exactly. It's like, he only knows like these super basic facts about her, like where she goes to school. And then it's like just like she likes music.
Well, when they do finally meet up, he does have that like, you're the love of my life, you don't know me. But and at first she's like, oh, it's too late, I'm engaged, I'm not interested. And then he basically tries to woo her over in like another montage of writing I love you, Sandra, like in different ways on different things.
Yeah, and planting a whole field of daffodils.
Yeah, that's probably the most like romantic comedy touch that you would have, where it's just like, where he's like, I had to call every florist in 5 states to get these all out here.
Yeah, and that I guess is the constant, is that he just has like his sheer conviction from everything, which is what that's what Danny DeVito tells him after he turns into the werewolf and comes back. And that's what he says, you know, yeah, you don't have a lot, but what you have a lot of. And that seems to be his answer to everybody. Like when they ask, like, how did you convince people to do that? And he's just like, I just told him that I needed, if you weren't going to do this, that I would never marry you. And that's how he convinces the twins to come with him and help him escape into back to America's, like, just shows him a picture of her and is like, she's the love of my life, I have to get back to her, and if I can't do that, I'll die trying.
Yeah, like he is a sweet talker, because when he lands in their amphitheater or whatever you want to call it, and they find him, well, the one's about to rat him out, but they hear him out and they essentially protect him from, you know, being killed or taken captive. And it's just like, yeah, he just has this ability to just win people over and win them over correctly. Now, it is his point of view from his story, but as you see when you get to the end, that these people do care about him. The real people do care about him. So I do feel like, yeah, he probably did find those twins and bring them back to America and had them work in Danny DeVito's circus.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, it's all real to some extent. He found him somewhere. He did something. And yeah.
Hey, maybe it takes place in Dumbo. I've watched those back to back. Everything's... And Danny DeVito does play the ringleader character again. So
it all comes full circle in the Burton verse. Yeah, there's a lot of good moments. And I think that another moment that again, like, highlights like his love for his wife is when Billy Crudup goes and visits Helena Bonham Carter, and like he just flat out asks her, like, were you having an affair with my dad? And He's like, oh, I thought you were going to wait an hour before you asked me that question. And, you know, we get that whole backstory of what he was trying to do. And, like, she did fall in love with him, but he still just has, like, that conviction that he's just like, no, I can't. I only love one person.
He's a stand-up guy.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it is a really nice moment where, like, he even apologizes. Like, I wasn't trying to lead you on or give you mixed signals. Like, that wasn't my intention. Like, it was literally to come in here and help you. It wasn't a romantic thing. And now I feel bad that that's even what you thought.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And she still, she ends up selling him the house so that he can preserve the entire town just to complete everything and, you know, just make it official.
Yeah. And that little town kind of reminded me a little bit of like Midsommar. It had that cult vibe to it when he got there, just because we just watched Midsommar just a couple weeks ago. But I had that vibe when they were like, come with us. And like the whole town's like, they're all wearing like white clothing and they're all like, follow us this way. I'm like, you're going to die. Well, I didn't feel that. When I watched this movie at all, I never felt like he was in fear of dying.
Yeah, like they tell him, you'll never find softer grass to walk on than Spectre. You'll never have better pie than Inspector.
The perfect temperature, yeah, Inspector.
It's never too hot, never too cold.
Yep, there's always a nice breeze, and when the wind goes through the trees, it sounds like an orchestra playing just for you.
Yeah, why would anyone ever want to leave? Like I said, that part of the movie is one that I always immediately start thinking of some of those old Twilight Zone episodes, like where the characters, you know, yeah, come upon like some magical place. Or I know there's the one where the guy goes back to when he was a kid and he's at like the carnival and stuff like that. Like that's immediately what I think of when I see that.
Yeah, it takes him a little bit to realize that he had went back into the past.
Yeah, yeah. Everything seems just a little odd.
I mean, if you weren't confused, you weren't in the Twilight Zone. Like, I think that every Twilight Zone was somebody taking at least half the episode
to figure out,
trying to figure out what the hell was going on. Yeah, they're always just super confused. And then when they do catch on, it's just like, I don't know, just them enjoying it. Do they enjoy it? I don't know.
Yeah, usually not.
Living in the moment, I guess. Either that or aliens. There weren't aliens in this movie.
No. Never got those.
I don't know. I kind of do like that the whole idea of Big Fish 2 is like a fish tale. It's just like, you know, people blowing the story out of proportion. But then it's also very literal. Like the whole story about Ewan McGregor meeting his wife or like winning her over was with that fish and the, you know, luring it with the wedding ring. Yeah. And if you think about it, more or less, that is what happened. You know what I mean? Like, he's not wrong. He's not wrong. It's just there. I mean, it's made up to a degree. I was like, too, whenever he was going into the water at the end and he takes his ring off and he gives it to Jessica Lange.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I don't know. Everything about the movie's perfect. Like, it really is. It's one of those few movies that there's almost nothing I would change about it. I think everyone is perfect in it. Everyone's cast perfectly. There's no one that sticks out that something's weird or that something was miscast. Like everything about this movie, I would agree. And I would say 2 weeks in a row, I think last week, Fisher King's probably my favorite Terry Gilliam movie. And I'd say this is probably my favorite Tim Burton movie, as much as I love, like, I would say I really do love Batman and Batman Returns, but they don't have that same emotional impact. Like if I'm talking about movies that have like a real like emotional impact on you, this is probably one of his, I almost want to say one of his only ones. A lot of his other movies, they're all, I don't know, that's very like a Tim Burton thing. Like everything's very artificial, which is like, he kind of does it on purpose to the way that he styles things. He wants everything to kind of have that heightened German expressionism type look to it, where everything kind of looks, everything looks fake. Nothing looks real, especially in the, you know, the designs of the Batman films or, you know, Sleepy Hollow is another one where he takes a lot of those ideas. So this is one of the few films that, even as fantastical as it is, it feels the most real. It doesn't have that fakeness to it that he puts in the movies that came before and the movies that have come after it. He does a lot of that, like, artificial look to a lot of things.
Or not as fun. Big Eyes kind of has that, like, it's more grounded than his usual movies too.
Yeah, that and Ed Wood has, like, Ed Wood is another one that, like, has a lot of heart to it. Like, it's a very, like, it's an emotional story in a different way, I guess. You know, it really is that a great story about, you know, maybe one of the most incompetent people, but he did love to make movies. Like, that's where you're like, I don't know how anyone could hate on Ed Wood. Like, yeah, his movies are terrible, but the guy just, like, really enjoyed making movies. Like, he really wanted to put his heart into making them, and all he could afford to do was get, old actors like Bela Lugosi and stuff like that. Like, that's all he could get was, like, kind of these washed up people and
Martin Landau.
Yeah. Yeah. Getting these old sets put together, you know, it is like a really charming story of a guy that, like, just wouldn't take no for an answer. Like, just was going to try his hardest to make movies, even though just clearly didn't know what he was doing, or it was clearly beyond his abilities.
Yeah. I think when it comes to Tim Burton, this is probably my favorite movie of his too, for the same exact reasons. I'm more emotionally invested in this movie than his other ones. But I would say the majority of his movies are really good. Even the ones that are kind of like sleepers. Like, I really like the new Frankenweenie movie. It's basically just a love letter to the Universal Monsters and Godzilla.
I do really like that movie.
But like my Dumbo rewatch, I thought Dumbo was very good. Like, I think Dumbo is very good. Maybe it has something to do with the fact that I don't think that the original was all that great. Also why I thought the Jungle Book was pretty good, because I thought the original was just okay. And then when we got to things like Lion King, I was like, that was a little rough, you know? That was such a great movie, and that live action one just felt off.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, everything else, like, he hits a period of time, like, people really, really despise his stuff. Like, I know a lot of people really hate Alice in Wonderland, or I remember Dark Shadows was, like, forgotten about, basically.
I like Dark Shadows. Like, it was really goofy, but I don't know. I enjoyed that one.
I don't really hate any of his movies. Yeah. Like, I'm trying to think of the ones that, like, even Alice in Wonderland's a prime example of, was it his best? No. It probably was his worst, but I just thought it was okay, you know? Or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I know some people hate that movie, and I'm like, I mean, it's obviously not Willy and the Wonka. It's not Willy Wonka, and you're not getting Gene Wilder back. But, like, I still don't think it's a bad movie.
It's not a bad movie. I mean, it is closer to the book, actually. He followed the book a lot more closely than the original film did. So, I mean, it's not like he wasn't trying. Yeah, I don't know. That's what I would say. I don't really hate any of his movies. I do really love Sleepy Hollow. Like, that is one that always comes back, and, like, especially, like, watching that and watching the old Hammer movies, and just seeing it stars a lot of the Hammer actors he pulls into that film, and that one's just a really fun, like, throwback movie.
Even, like, I didn't have a fond memory of Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and I rewatched it, I think, last year or the year before, and I liked it. I was like, I don't know, wasn't madly in love with it, but, like, I thought it was pretty good. And then from him to go from that into Batman into Beetlejuice, I haven't revisited Mars Attacks in a while, but I kind of remember that being, like, not the best.
Yeah, that's one I haven't watched in quite a while. I don't know. I remember kind of liking
revisit it on the
I remember kind of liking it as a kid, but then I can remember, like, watching it, it's still been a while, but I can remember watching it like when I got older and just being like, what is this?
I do remember too it having like 24 main characters. Like it
had so many main characters. Jack Nicholson got to play two roles.
Yeah, I think that they said that the script, no one liked the script, so he just cast like every big person that he could get his hands on, and then like the movie still stunk.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe we will eventually get to somewhere where we'll touch on that one again. And hey, we just recently did the Apes movies, and I think we both agreed that we both enjoyed rewatching his Planet of the Apes more than we thought we were going to.
Yeah, that was another one that I really thought I wasn't even thinking about that, but yeah, when I talked about directors that we previously done, I wasn't even thinking about his Planet of the Apes remake. Yeah, I was surprised by how much I liked it this time around.
Yeah. Yeah, I had fun with it. I thought it was, I don't know, something about, getting a different sense of it, putting it in context with all of the Apes films that we were going through that, he made some interesting choices in it. He didn't do, I at least applaud that he didn't just flat out remake Planet of the Apes and call it a day. He at least did a lot of things different. And there's even...
Gus Van Sant.
Yeah. Yeah, not a shot-for-shot remake. There's even stuff that he did that they actually started using in the later Apes movies that we talked about, like some of the ideas that he even threw out there that they started using. So, yeah, I think I enjoy most of his movies. I haven't had a movie of his that I can say, like, oh, I would never watch that again.
To me, he's like somebody when I grew up, I was more like obsessed with. Like, I really liked his stuff. And then for a long time, I didn't really watch anything because I think it was just, you're too familiar with it, so you don't revisit it as much. But everything holds up because, like, one of my favorite ones is Batman Returns. I watch it all the fucking time. And every time I watch it, I'm like, that movie, for as weird as it is really good. Like, it wins me over. I'm going to say that's most of them. There's tons of movies. Yeah. Like, it has that touch where, like, you can see it on TV. Any of these, like Beetlejuice is on, you can sit down and watch it and the whole thing's enjoyable. But yeah, I guess we'll have to put our next Tim Burton's probably has to be Mars Attacks then. We got to visit that.
I would like to rewatch that because like I said, it has definitely been a long time other than maybe catching like a bit of it on like, I don't know, TNT or something when you're just like put a random channel on or something that I've maybe seen a bitter piece of it, but it has been
it would be on TNT.
Yeah, 100%. I know for a fact that movie would be on their plane.
It wouldn't be on TCM, but it would be on TNT.
Yeah, they would be the ones airing it. So yeah, I think it's definitely we're gonna have to make that one of our future endeavors.
Yeah, do you even know what he's making now? Because I know Dumbo came out 2 years ago, that was a movie that I was like not remotely excited when he announced it.
I thought he was doing another Disney one.
Like a big one?
I thought he was doing, I thought he was working
on The Emperor's New Groove or something.
He doesn't have anything listed on IMDb other than Beetlejuice 2 is listed as his next project.
And is that even real?
I mean, it's listed on IMDb, so that's as real as I can say it is. It has a screenwriter listed on it.
Here's my thing too that I find fascinating. Apparently, it's happening with Michael Keaton right now, but a couple years ago, it happened with Harrison Ford, where he basically has revisited every major character that he's ever played, and now Michael Keaton's like, he's Batman again. He's Beetlejuice again.
Yeah, we're hitting that time period where they need to hurry up and make these movies while they can. Yeah, we're getting we're still apparently getting Indiana Jones 5. Feels very much like no one was asking for it, but I guess they want to leave on a better note than Crystal Skull. They want to try to go on a much more beloved note.
Hey, that's how I feel about Daniel Craig's return as Bond. Like, maybe No Time to Die ends up being awful, but I wanted it because I thought that, we could do better than Spectre. Which ties into Big Fish.
Yeah, so. It really does somehow. It all comes back to Spectre.
It all comes back to Spectre. Yeah, Tim Burton's like, I can't think of the last thing of his that I was excited about. Because honestly, Big Fish was a movie that my dad was like, when my dad was over in the Iraq War, he had like bootlegs for being over there. So he sent me back a bootleg of Big Fish. And it was really grainy and not easy to watch. But like when I got it was like taped in the movie theater, like bad. That's how I saw it the first time. And I was like, oh, that's really good. And then when I actually saw it like on DVD, I was like, damn, this is a pretty good movie. It's also where I saw Kill Bill for the first time.
It's an interesting way to view that. You didn't
bootlegs.
Yeah, you didn't have
actually Kill Bill's looked like it was ripped off of some digital copy. Okay. Like it was like pristine.
I was about to say you didn't have Jerry in there filming for you, bringing his real artistic vision to his bootlegging.
No, that's kind of, I wish I had it because like the box looked like, obviously it was off, but like somebody made the time to make like a box art for the damn thing. And yeah, Big Fish was like one of those ones where like sometimes you couldn't even tell what the hell was happening. Like when he was underwater, you couldn't tell, like when he was sitting in the car and it rained so hard that he was underwater, like you couldn't tell what the fuck was happening at all. I do like how his, where he sees the naked woman, who the little girl who ends up becoming the witch describes her as just a fish. You know, she's something that you can't catch and she looks different to other people. And I like how he describes Jessica Lange as this, his lady in the river as he's, you know, going into the river at the end of the movie. I think that's kind of a sweet moment.
Yeah, it's a good finale there. Good way to tie it all back that, yeah, she's always been his, and they, you know, it was destined.
And I don't know the name of the show, but there's an HGTV show where they're fixing up a town, and it's the town that has the Big Fish house in it. Which is really funny because my wife and her mother.
Which house are you talking about? His house? Like the house that they live in?
The house that the whole family, like the real house that like the family lives in.
Because I had also seen, I was reading that you can still visit the town of Spectre, that is an actual location, like that you can go visit. All the buildings are still there.
Well, I had the same question. They told me that they're like the Big Fish houses in it. And I'm thinking, there's a lot of houses in Big Fish. Like, is there like a specific one that it is? And then I think I was told, oh, it's the one that they're in. I'm like, okay. But it was definitely the that white house that's like up on the hill.
The house with the white picket fence that he wanted for his family.
Yeah, that's legitimately what it is. And they tried to recreate things inside of it to make it look like it did in the movie. It seems like a really nice house from in the movie, though. I think of when Billy Crudup goes upstairs and there's that, it happens like three times, where's that, there's that shot of the hallway before he goes into his father's room. And I'm like, that is the biggest hallway I've ever seen. It is like three hallways put together.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll just use the crammed houses, but I'm just like, that hallway is like massive. So yeah, HGTV, they're covering Big Fish too. Yeah, I think that's, I don't know. Obviously, with this movie and many other movies, I get surprised by things that I had no expectations for. And Big Fish is one of them. Like, I'm more likely to be let down on something that, like, if I loved the novel and I'm like, oh, they're going to fuck it up. I don't know. I'm kind of forgiving, too.
You just let everything go.
I don't let everything go, but, like, I understand to an extent that they can't make the book perfect. Like, the person that's like, I never imagined them being played by that person.
Yeah.
Probably. Like, okay, sure. I can agree with that.
I see that pop up all the time for, and it's this very specific. I'll see articles for Harry Potter in particular that's like, this is how those characters are actually supposed to look. And it's like a picture of, It'd be like a picture of Daniel Craig with like, or not Daniel Craig, Daniel Radcliffe with like,
I would like to see what Daniel, you know,
Daniel Craig is Harry Potter. It'll just be like a picture of Daniel Radcliffe photoshopped with like slightly bigger ears or something like that. And they're like, see, it's not like the book. Cause there, you know, there's a chapter where J.K. Rowling's like, he had enormous ears. It's stupid yeah. stuff like that.
Even books that I've revisited many, many times, they put in an actor that has like blonde hair instead of black hair. I don't really care as long as they can pull it off. Like I think of even things like The Dark Tower, where they had Idris Elba in it as Roland, and I thought he was a really good Roland. I thought the movie was trash. Maybe we'll revisit that too. Movies that we think are trash from our memories.
You know, that's a weird thing that I run into, though. I will say, like it doesn't affect me. But if I've seen a movie with a like based on a book, and then I go to read the book, sometimes like in your mind you're just like, oh, I'm just gonna like, I'll think of the character as looking like this because I've seen the movie. So it's like, it does like throw off your thing when you're like if you read Jaws after having watched the movie so many times, and then something weird will be like Matt Hooper's long blonde hair, and you're like, Richard Dreyfuss did not have long blonde hair. And it's like, it just, yeah. it just like hits you and you're just like, no, I will not be imagining Hooper with long blonde hair.
Yeah. Right. It's Richard Dreyfuss in your, it's, in yeah, your it's, entire mind.
Yeah. Once you've seen a movie like that, like if you go back to read Jaws, it's like, no, it's going to be Richard Dreyfuss, Roy Scheider and Robert Shaw. Like I'm not going to imagine it with anybody else.
That's how Game of Thrones was for me. I was reading them after I watched the show. So like even how they were describing some of them, I think like Daenerys is like a 13-year-old girl, and I'm like,
you're like, no, not in my imagination.
Actually, they're all supposed to be young. Like even Jon Snow is supposed to be like 14 or something too, and I'm like, no, I just picture all the actors from the show. I guess there's points where like I have to pick which actor I want because they've swapped them out, but. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think some stuff like that's fine. I mean, I feel like I have an imagination and I can wing it with whatever I'm watching or reading, I guess. But yeah, when we end up watching things, those maybe don't meet our expectations. For me, my expectations being let down are I'm just really excited about whatever coming out. It looks really good. And then maybe I get something really generic. So, like, I saw Hereditary. Hereditary looked like a generic dollhouse horror movie or something. So, like, it kind of really surprised me. And I was like, wow, that was really, really fucking good. And then there's other movies where, like, I love Skyfall. And then we get into Spectre. And I'm like, it's not that it was bad, but, like, you could have done better. You know what I mean? Like, it could have been so much better. It was just a very okay movie. But I don't know. Maybe we'll get Big Fish 2 in a couple of years.
Maybe.
We'll see what happens. But yeah, if you haven't seen the movie, they did just release a new 4K version of it, which I ended up picking up, and I thought it looked fucking phenomenal. So I definitely recommend that. I don't know what streaming platforms it's on, but if for any reason you haven't seen it, there you go. Go watch it on Hulu. Is that where you watched it, Chuck?
Well, it's where I was going to watch it, but I think I have the Hulu version with ads, and I didn't feel like watching the ads, so I did have to find the DVD that I have for it. So I did look it up to see where it was streaming, like if it was going to be on Netflix, but it was like Hulu. I was like, then I'll have to watch commercials. I don't want to watch it on there.
There was something for the other podcast, I rewatched the 1998 Godzilla film. And I was like, this has to be streaming somewhere. And it was only streaming on like, it only was on Amazon, but it would cost you like $5 to watch it. And it was nowhere to be found. And I'm like, why is the Godzilla so hard to find? Like, I thought it'd be on HBO Max since they were getting the new Godzilla versus Kong. Well, I pulled out the DVD and I'm thinking, oh, it's probably gonna look terrible on my television. It didn't. It looked, I mean, the CG is rough, but I thought that it actually looked really good. I'm like, this must be one of those like first DVDs where they were like really making the blacks dark and everything, and they didn't get lazy with it. So it's like it is actually a really nice cut of the movie on DVD.
Nice.
But yeah, we'll be back next week with another movie. That's kind of our thing. We'll probably have a new one next week.
Probably.
Through most of the year. I don't know when our next break is. We don't give ourselves breaks anymore. Yeah, it's not too hard to watch a movie once a week and talk about it one night.
Yeah.
But it's your pick next.
Yeah. Be interesting when we get to it. Not going to talk any more about it.
Sounds good to me. You want to follow us on Twitter? We're at Cinema Di More. Facebook.com/CinemaDiMore. That is where we're going to show some ads. And you'll know what we're doing right beforehand if you follow us there. But thank you for listening. I guess I really need a but. There's no but. Thank you for listening. We really appreciate it. We're just a very small, we're just having small conversations, and hopefully somebody's out there enjoying this.
Yeah.
One big Tim Burton fan.
Somebody likes it.
And then we offended them by talking smack on Mars Attacks, which we both agreed that we have to revisit. So I'm taking it out of the it's bad basket, putting it into the maybe it's bad basket. Yeah. And maybe like Planet of the Apes before it, I'll say, hey, you know what? I liked it. It wasn't that bad. But we'll see you next Friday. Thanks. We are Cinema Di More. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter to stay up to date with news and information on upcoming episodes. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audible, Pandora, Alexa, or iHeartRadio. It would be greatly appreciated if you subscribe to our podcast on your platform of choice. We also appreciate feedback, so rate us, review us, and let us know what you think. And above all else, thank you for listening.